You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Ginny.
I'm Natalie.
And I'm Jen.
And we are the art history babes.
Oh man, so we are in 2017 now.
2017!
That's crazy. We were just thinking just a little while ago about time. We only have 2 quarters left in our graduate program, y'all.
What?
Oh,
that's so crazy.
I'm a little bit afraid. I'm like, I don't like it. I kind of just want to be in grad school forever.
Well, if I could.
I mean, I know. It's just, if I could have the cool parts without all the, horrible, this paper's due.
Exactly.
And it's horrible.
I could just do grad school without, the papers.
We have a friend that's kind of doing that. She finished and now she's just still a TA and she's like, I'm having the best time of my life.
She's reading so many books for leisure.
She's reading like young adult fiction.
Great.
Yeah.
That will be us soon enough.
It will be us.
We'll be relaxing in Europe reading young adult novels.
See, I'm not gonna be relaxing in Europe. I'm gonna just be like, we gotta go. We're gonna just wake up and just start drinking. Like, the whole time, we're just gonna be on a bender and try to, chase, keep the hangover at bay.
Holy shit.
I mean, that's how I...
I don't know if that's gonna work.
Oh, come on, guys. Where's your sense of adventure? All I'm saying is
if I'm on a bender, I'm not going to want to adventure. I'm just gonna, want to be drunk at, a...
Instead of
going places and seeing things,
I've never been on a bender. So
really?
I'm just kidding about that. Yeah.
You've never been on, any kind of bender before?
No, because the longest I can drink is probably, 8 hours before I black out and ruin my life somehow.
But a bender, if you're doing a multiple-day bender, you're not necessarily, drinking constantly. You're just,
So it's
consistently drinking.
Consistently drinking.
But you still sleep and you still have a meal and you take breaks.
I feel now I have to try to have a bender.
Oh, God.
Just to see what it's like.
I had one in undergrad. I was living with, I was staying with my boyfriend at the time and he lived in a house with all dudes and they partied all the time. And that summer we did a 10-day bender.
Whoa.
Yeah. And by the end of it, it was so funny.
Your skin was dripping off your face.
It was so weird because it was so consistent that, at the end of it, I didn't have a hangover. None of us did. We weren't hungover, but we just hated everything.
Right.
We were just everything is terrible.
Ginny looks
disgusting.
This is awful.
I mean, I'm not recommending this, but it was an experience.
Yeah, we're not. I feel as soon as I get off this ridiculous diet, I am going to go on a bender. Just a weekend bender.
Weekend bender.
That sounds like a good amount.
You don't want to pull a 10-day bender while you're in
grad school. I cannot. Yeah, so the next couple of podcasts will be less of me yelling because I'm not imbibing with the rest of the girls, but it's
cool. You're
drinking
licorice tea.
I got my Egyptian licorice tea, and it's very delicious.
Yeah.
So, Yogi Tea, sponsor us. It's really good.
And you get the little, messages on the...
Oh, yeah. Let me read it. little sample of the positive messages that come with yogi tea. Compassion is a state of constant giving for the self, of the self, for others.
Oh, it is. That's nice.
That is nice.
That is nice.
Be compassionate. Wow.
Yeah. Good things, Yogi.
Good things to remember in 2017.
Thanks, Yogi Tea. Thanks for your organic tea. Do you guys do this? I just daydream and I get lost.
All the time. Of course. Yeah.
And I was just doing that and I was just thinking, like, wow, you know, wouldn't that be so cool if someone was just listening and was like, psh, I'm going to send them a crate of wine. And we just get like a crate of like interesting wines. I mean, that would just be so cool.
Yeah. Putting that out into the universe.
Right. Okay, so we're done asking for your money and your wine. And we're going to jump right in. We're going to talk about Impressionism today.
Impressionism.
It's a giant topic, so we're not going to obviously cover everything, but we thought it would be fun to do some of these, like, movement episodes and talk about these big sort of moments in art history. So we'll try to do that a little bit more often. But right now, I'm going to pass it on to Nat.
Hey.
Impressionism as a movement is kind of like all of these art movement terms that we have where it's made up usually by art historians. This one actually has a little bit more interesting of a story behind the title. So beginning in 1874, there was a show in Paris, and it was unusual for art exhibitions as they were generally run by salons, where you would have a board of hoity-toity people who would pick the best of the best and kind of get to decide what is good art, what should be displayed, what's important, yada yada. You get a lot of history paintings, which I don't know if we've talked about that a lot, but history paintings are, they're kind of like these idealized, glorified stories, generally having to do with mythology or history or, you know, religion. They're very moralistic. They tend to be what people would call, like, quote-unquote realistic, but just, like, being as close to the natural world as a painter could get. So illusionism, trying to make it look really three-dimensional and crazy. 1874, this group, the Artists Anonymous, are a group of independent artists who decisively break away from the salon-style exhibition. They come together and host a smaller exhibition, including themselves. I don't remember the exact number of artists, but it was a small group. Included names that you guys might know, such as Claude Monet, Edgar Degas, and Camille Pissarro, among others. And they just kind of wanted to stick it to this whole elitist academy salon style of art making and presenting. And the name Impressionist was nowhere to be found at this point, but came about afterward when a critic named Louis Leroy wrote a scathing review about the show and in particular Monet's Impression Sunrise. Oh. So yeah, it's a beautiful painting. It's of a port. You can see the outlines of the ships, but it is very loose, painterly brushstrokes.
I love that red sun.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
so it's love mostly it. Cool colors, and then what Jen is referring to is this bright orangish-red sun right in the center, and you get a beautiful reflection on the water. It's dreamy, it's beautiful, and Leroy wrote that he called it a mere impression, and impression is a term that, like, it loosely means sketch, so it's a sketch of a painting, and it was meant to be an insult, but the name stuck, and
I feel like that happens a lot with movement names. It's always meant to be, like, an insult, and then
that
they're
happened
like,
to
we'll
the,
take it.
That happened to the Fauves, which are, like, a subset of Impressionism. And Fauves being wild animals.
Yeah,
and
it was wild beasts.
Right, yeah. And they were like, hell yeah. That sounds badass. Thank you.
Yeah, so meant to be an insult, born into a movement. And they were meant to be impressions. This is intentional by the artist, but not in a, like, lazy manner. The unfinished nature is supposed to reflect the momentary and kind of, like, the impression of that exact moment in place and time for that particular artist. So what they're really rebelling against is this idea that what the Academy teaches a certain way to paint, and that there are higher forms of painting and lower forms of painting, and that there's a correct way to paint and there's a wrong way to paint, and there's a lot of rules in place. And these artists are looking around at kind of a changing society, but also Paris in particular went through a lot of change around this time. You have the Industrial Revolution, you have the emergence of a middle class, upper middle class, where a lot of these artists come from. They are just kind of wanting to rewrite the rules and paint what they perceive as their reality rather than what they're being told to paint in the Academy. And it's really interesting. And I think that, I don't know, I was not super well-versed in this time period of painting at all, or this movement a few years ago. But it's super interesting once you kind of get all of the context. Because they do seem a little simple right off the bat, I would say. That might just be me. But if you understand the context and the position of these artists, it opens a lot of interesting avenues to interpret these.
I feel like a lot of Impressionist works, they seem like a mix of, like, genre paintings. Like, we talked about, like, Baroque genre paintings and then, like, Romanticism. Like,
right.
Come together.
Yeah.
Into... Yeah, I think. Mm-hmm.
And definitely. Honestly, I think that with the context, yeah, Impressionism does begin to make a lot of sense just in the time period alone. So, like, Paris is undergoing these, like, rapid changes. The city is trying to modernize, and so there's this swell of technological advances in mm-hmm. industry, mm-hmm. and so a lot of these artists said, like, well, and there's a really good quote that I read in this book called The Lost World of the Impressionists that said, "To hell with the civilized world, long live nature and old poetry." And so a bunch of these artists just decided to go out to the countryside and really wanted to mm-hmm. sort of preserve the rapidly changing landscape. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's why we see this preoccupation with landscape and these sort of fleeting moments, and mm-hmm. because everything was changing very fast.
Yeah, and I don't know if you guys, Baron Haussmann and his whole renovation of yeah. Paris. So
Haussmannization.
Yeah, so Haussmann's new Paris, all of these buildings are being created in a new style of architecture, and it's just, there's a lot of change going on in Paris at this time. So this uprise of the leisure class, and what's interesting in relation to what Jen was saying, you do see a lot of, like, landscape and stuff, but you also see a lot of urban landscape, and you see, like, portraiture, and it's interesting how, while the style and kind of the frustration with the art scene at this time is reflected in all of these artists, they each hone into a different, kind of like a different motif. So, like, I don't know, Degas was all about the ballerinas, mm-hmm. and then you get, Monet was a lot more into nature and landscapes, but then you get people like Caliboat who are all about, like, the dandy and urban Paris. So they each kind of, like, latch onto different things, but have the same kind of general idea about how art should be created at this time and presented and understood. And another important thing to realize is that they saw themselves as realists. It's not like they were trying to do something, like, crazy radical with, like, loose brushstrokes, like, make it abstract. This wasn't, to them, abstraction. It was them taking what they saw as their reality, as contemporary Paris, or wherever they may have been. Most of this took place in Paris, that's why we're kind of harping on that. Taking in their reality through their own impression and then putting it on the canvas. So they were being modern, but they weren't headed into abstractions yet. They were far from that.
Well, there's, like, a lot of overlap between paintings that were considered realist paintings mm-hmm. and Impressionism. Like, Courbet mm-hmm. is, like, widely considered a realist painter, but he's also an important figure in Impressionism. So it's kind of, like, this interesting, like, realism, and then what is considered one of the first forms of abstraction.
Yeah.
The idea mm-hmm. that they, like, overlap is kind of interesting.
It is. Same with, like, Manet, which is why I think a lot of people freaked out about Manet in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's, like, just bending the rules, where they're like, wait, this is different. Yeah. Wait, I don't like this.
And while Manet was not considered an Impressionist, he was not in the group, he is perceived by many people as, like, the forefather of the Impressionists.
Mm-hmm.
a lot of the members of the Impressionist group look to him. His most famous and scandalous of his paintings, Olympia, which was painted in 1856, so about 20 years prior to the first Impressionist show, was a great example of this because it caused quite an uproar. If you're not familiar, we will post a picture, but it is a lady. She's laying on a bed and she is completely nude. And she is being handed a bouquet of flowers by her African maidservant in the background. She has a little corbeau, actually styled cat, at the end of her bed. That's fierce. This painting was really poorly received. There were, like, insanely scathing reviews. I don't know if you guys have read some of them, but...
A long time ago, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They said that she looked dead. Most people just likened her completely to a corpse. They would talk about her being in the morgue. Her skin is a little bit yellowish.
Yeah, there's like a coldness to her skin, and she's a lot more harshly... Okay, so the problem is not that she's nude. That's okay.
That's been done.
Okay, yeah. The problem is not the nudity.
Yeah.
The problem is the cold harshness of her nudity. So there are thick contours mm-hmm. that outline her body. So none of the sort of gauzy sort
right,
of.
Right.
So think of the Grand Odalisque. Who right. did that?
Mm-hmm.
Who was that?
Titian.
No, not Titian.
Venus of Urbino was Titian.
Yeah.
Aang.
Yeah, so that kind of nudity is okay mm-hmm. because it's this...
It's like a voyeuristic gaze.
Yeah, like she's kind of looking back at you mm-hmm. like, oh, and like the body is very soft.
Right,
we
right.
get the impression that this woman has never stood up in her entire life.
Yeah.
The joints are vague and she might have knees. We don't know. So that is... the more acceptable salon nude, whereas Olympia, which is the name, even Olympia was like a parody of those
right.
other like odalisque mm-hmm. paintings.
Yeah.
And what really struck many people about this painting is that many people were so freaked out by the fact that it looked like it could be a real high class prostitute
yeah.
that many of these men who are at the salon with their ladies, with their wives, are like, oh shit, this looks like the broad I just visited in her apartment like 2 weeks ago. And so it was just too real.
Mm-hmm.
And that like just freaked everybody out.
It harshed everyone's vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And on top of like the way that it's painted and everything, it's a direct reference to Titian's Venus of Urbino. Mm-hmm. I mean,
yeah.
We'll definitely. Put both of them up. It's very obvious. It was very intentional. But there are, like, subtle differences, whereas, like, in Titian's Venus of Urbino, she's a goddess. She's Venus. So,
yeah.
you know, that, right off the bat, makes it easier to digest. And then she's kind of, like, longingly looking at you, and she has a hand, like, draped coyly by her genitalia, like, kind of covering it, but also kind of drawing attention to it,
mm-hmm.
you know? In Olympia, she's sitting in a very similar position, but a little more rigid, and she's looking directly at the viewer, not in, like, an angry way, but definitely confrontational. Like, she's acknowledging that you are looking at her, and
mm-hmm.
that hand, rather than being kind of, like, caressing her leg, is stiff, gripping her leg, and clearly, like, covering herself. So there's just all of these really subtle differences where Manet's using the idea of the creative copy and referencing these paintings, but also kind of holding up a mirror to society and being like, okay, guys, you know, let's talk about this. And he was a really clever dude. He did it with a lot of other paintings. We could do a whole Manet episode.
Yeah.
And
talk about the cat.
Oh, the cat. The cat's
that
fun.
That damn cat.
So Titian's Venus of Urbino, there is a dog at the end of the bed. And not to get too far into it, but it was a painting made for a wedding gift for this the Duke of Urbino's new wife. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, filled with all of these kind of, like, subtle hints.
Right.
And a dog means fidelity, loyalty. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of like, hey, look at that cute little sleeping puppy at the end of your painting. Yeah, you better stay loyal to me.
Like and, a cute little sleeping puppy.
Yeah, right? Aww. And you better be beautiful and sexy like a goddess. Pure. Yeah, it's just, it's
puppies.
It's just soft and non-threatening, and there's a puppy, and aww.
Just loves you.
So Manet instead takes the puppy out, and he puts this arched black cartoonish cat. Like, it's almost like, comical.
The cat like, is pissed.
Yeah,
it is. The cat's like, get out of here! Yeah. And it's like, it's, I never even noticed the cat for years, and then I finally saw, like, a good resolution picture of the painting, right? And I was like, look at that cat!
Yeah, so you guys can, I mean, you can kind of figure out the tongue-in-cheek reference there, like, cat, you know. It's not even really, like, pure symbolism, like, it's more just, like, kind of a joking, haha. So I don't want to put words in Manet's mouth, or brush, or however you want to say it.
And I mean,
it.
Just in general, like, cats represent something very different than dogs.
Yeah,
absolutely.
They're so much more fierce and independent.
They're wild. And, yeah. Like, they kind of come into your house sometimes, but for the most part, they're out there killing stuff. And for the longest time, I think cats were, like, associated with, like, evil and whatnot.
Yeah. They still kind of are.
In, like,
sometimes.
Europe, you know? That was, like, a whole thing.
And it's a black cat, you know?
Mm-hmm. Associated with cat. Witches.
Yeah,
that's the
maybe
devil.
Maybe Olympia was a witch.
That is the devil.
That's the devil.
Oh my God. Yeah, so that painting just caused a stir, but is still, like, crazy talked about nowadays. It's just, it's not going away anytime soon.
No
so.
One will shut up about it.
I don't want to shut up about it. Yeah. It's super interesting.
I want to just keep talking about Olympia and her. I like her cute little choker.
Yeah, right? Seriously.
Yeah. She's got the choker.
She's got the choker that every girl wears now.
Yeah. Olympia.
I pointed that out to my students.
She did it first.
Yep. She did, honestly. I never thought about that
I didn't
before.
Either. Mm-hmm. I'm going to think about that every time I wear my little crystal choker now.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just like,
Olympia.
Yeah.
Olympia. So everyone who's posting selfies with your chokers, hashtag Olympia. Yeah, so I'm going to pass it off to Corey, who's going to talk about one of the other amazing aspects of the Impressionists, which is that women were highly involved in the movement, not just like, you know, like you look at the Baroque and like, yeah, Artemisia Gentileschi was doing stuff, but like, no, these women were involved very much so in this movement, and it's fucking awesome.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, ladies. So I'm just going to talk briefly about a very important lady artist who we will also, I'm sure, do an entire episode on at some point.
We gotta
do it. Mary Cassatt. She's a big deal.
Man, she's such a babe.
She is. Mary Cassatt was originally from Pittsburgh, and she trained at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia. In 1873, she moved to Paris and meets Degas, which kind of gets her into this impressionist circle. Yeah, she meets Degas in 1877 and then exhibits with the impressionists from 1879 to 1886. So for a good amount of time, she's hanging out with the whole impressionist circle. She is often known for her representations of mothers and children together, which is a really important thing to be just representing that doesn't get enough representation, I think, in art history up until this point. Like, just this sensitive bond, like, between mother and child.
It's,
and,
like, a rare theme, which is weird,
right?
Actually.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know why.
Mothers and daughters.
It's, you know, the patriarchy. But they are. They're so scared of the lady power.
That wandering uterus.
But yeah, so she's known for representations of mothers and children, which are very beautiful, and they are, they're very sensitive. They're usually representing kind of intimate moments between mothers and children. I'm going to talk about one of her most well-known paintings called In the Loge, also referred to as A Woman in Black at the Opera.
Ooh, The Loge.
The Loge. That's what The Loge is.
I love that painting so much.
The Loge is an opera house. And this painting was painted in 1880, and it is currently housed at the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, which is an institution I feel like I need to go to, because I feel like so much is there. Like,
yeah, yes. I always end up citing it somehow.
Yeah.
Right? So
much art.
Gotta go.
Gotta go sometime. We'll hit up Boston eventually.
Get some cannoli. Can't wait.
It's gonna be great. Okay, so some context for this painting. The Paris Opera opened a new building in 1875. When this happened, the opera house soon became a favorite subject of the Impressionists. In addition to Mary Cassatt, Renoir, Degas, and Manet all painted scenes from the opera house. And this was because the Paris Opera was one of the only public places that women could attend freely and kind of observe social life. Like, you didn't need to be in the company of a man to go to the opera house. Likewise, when you think opera, you think it's all elite. And, like, the elite people were definitely there and were definitely, like, showing off that they were there. But really, people of all, like, classes were welcome.
They had plebeian seats, for sure.
Yeah, totally. So, really, you're going to see a whole array of people. You kind of have this, like, breakdown of the social order, almost.
It's
like
a spectacle.
Yeah, it's, like, all people going to the opera house. Right. So, this makes it really good, like, fodder for artwork, because you have all these different kinds of people interacting, talking, looking at each other, like, just behaving in the same place, which wasn't a thing that happened a lot at the time.
Oh, have you seen Johnson with his new mistress? Oh, scandal!
Exactly.
I don't know why his name is Johnson.
Yeah, I was like, I know Johnson.
So friend.
Johnson.
Pierre Johnson. But so the opera house was a really interesting place just in terms of, like, voyeurism, because you had so many different types of people, and it really allowed the artist to examine both the observer and the observed, like, interacting in this very interesting way. Likewise, like I said, it was a place for the elite, and it was a place in which young ladies of a certain class would be, like, judged in this setting as, like, whether they're, like, marryable or, you know, like, if you were if you were a young lady in an elite class, you were supposed to present yourself a certain way at the opera, right? So, like, it was still a place for, like, the male gaze, essentially.
Absolutely.
For men to, you know, look at women and deem them worthy, basically. So what's so great about this painting is that Cassatt is basically, like, turning the tables here. Because what you have is an image of a woman gazing out at the opera house, but it's before the opera's even started. So you already have this connotation of, like, the social aspect of the opera house. And she's by herself, and she's this mature but very, like, just, like, striking, like, well-dressed woman. And she's, like, the main subject of the painting. And she's gazing out through the little, like, opera binoculars, and she's just looking out at people. So you have this flip of, like, the observed is becoming the observer, right? And it's, like, putting it into the control of the woman, which is interesting.
This guy.
Yeah.
We gotta talk about the guy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so in the background, like, so the main focus is this woman, like, she's up close. And then in the background, you kind of see a few people, but it's the Impressionist style, so you can't really see their faces. The brushwork kind of blends together, though the main woman is the only one you can really make out details of. But you can see some people in the background, and there is an individual that's clearly a male that is gazing directly back at the woman who's looking outward. So you, like I said, you have this really interesting interplay of, like, who's looking at who.
Right, yeah. And like, she's not looking at him.
Yeah.
She's looking somewhere else.
And like, she doesn't give a shit.
She doesn't give a shit about this guy. Like, she's not, she doesn't even know that he exists.
Also, doesn't he look like a little worm to you guys?
Yeah.
He has no hair, he's kind of, like, shaped like a worm.
He's got, like, no hair, and what I love about his body language is that his arm is kind of, like, holding on to something, and there's what looks like another woman next to him. So he's like grabbing on to the chair and he's almost like hanging out of the balcony.
Yeah.
Trying to get a good look at this babe. He's just like, oh my God. Look at how hot
no,
she
he's,
is.
No, yeah, his body is totally turned away from like.
From the actual.
From like the stage.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And hers is. My favorite part is hers is then turned away from him.
Right.
So the hand that she's using to hold the binoculars is actually, like, blocking him out.
Right. That's why he's, like, about to fall out of the damn balcony trying to get a look at her with his little binoculars. And it's just so funny. It's really well put together.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's super smart. And it's just, like, and the colors are beautiful. It's got this color palette of, like, dark reds and black and then like some cream colors to lighten
like
it up.
It's like a rich mahogany.
For real. No, it's beautiful. Also, this book that we're looking at right now is super cool. I got it really cheap at Barnes & Noble and it's called The Impressionists by Diana Nawal.
Art in Detail.
Art in Detail.
Oh, dude. I have another book by her that's fantastic. She is very cool. She is cool.
That's cool. You heard it here. She's cool. She is cool.
Diana Newall.
Yeah, because she does
art
those
history
great,
babe.
Like details.
Yeah.
Of different.
There's
works
these,
of art.
There's
it's
these
great.
Cool little like circles cut out to like highlight
to like zoom in, and then she breaks down every painting she looks at. She totally breaks down the color palette.
It's the coolest.
And like. It's not just like your typical textbook where you just have the image and then they say some stuff. The images she talks about, she goes in detail and you have repeated images and like details and it's just, it's a really cool book.
That is super cool. I want more. I want these.
I want more.
I want to go find some.
What do you know what kind of book you have by her? So it's a massive book and it's called, the book itself is called Art in Detail.
Oh, nice.
That's cool. So it's hardcover, super huge, and it covers like various periods, all kinds of artists, and it will do that same thing where it zooms in on different aspects, talks about the color, composition. I'll bring it for, I'm sure I'll use it for plenty of episodes.
So dope.
Diana Nawal, check her out. She's awesome. So that's all I really got to say about Mary Cassatt right now. I'm going to pass it over to Ginny. She's going to talk about another badass lady impressionist.
Yeah. Lady.
Yes, yes, yes. So a contemporary of Mary Cassatt is my girl, Bert Morisot. Morisot?
Morisot.
You got
Bert
it.
Morisot.
Beautiful.
French is tricky for me.
It's tricky for everybody. That's a rough one.
So Bert was born in 1841 in France, and she began her kind of training in art as taking drawing lessons with her sisters in Paris. And she was taught by the artist Joseph Guichard. Sorry. We'll have it on the website. It's Guichard. Guichard.
French is hard.
I'm so sorry.
Sorry, Joseph.
She also copied landscapes of the artist Camille Corot and did a lot with the kind of plein air painting style. And so in 1867, she met Manet and became a part of his kind of like inner circle of artists, including Pissarro, Degas, Cezanne, Sisley, Monet, and Renoir. She also sat for Manet in some of his paintings. One of them includes Les Reposes. And she was very highly criticized for the way that she looked in this painting. And we'll put an image up of it on the website. And I actually have it pulled up on my phone so you guys can see it too. But she was called the Queen of Slovenliness.
Oh my God.
She was so damn critical about that.
She doesn't look that way at all. And they were saying that she wasn't moral.
I lay like that every single day of my life.
She just looks fine. She doesn't look slovenly at all.
She's just chilling.
Yeah.
She honestly looks bored.
Yeah, she just looks slightly relaxed. Like, yeah. That's...
How dare she?
I know, right?
But haters were hating. But that didn't get Bert down, because Bert was... She just kept plugging. So she painted largely everyday scenes and portraits. In 1874, she had 9 paintings in the first Impressionist exhibition. And she continued to show at the following exhibitions until about 1886. So she was very, very present in the Impressionist exhibitions and kind of the Impressionist movement as a whole. She had a painting from 1873, which is just simply called Reading, which is a lovely painting of a woman reading in some kind of like very bucolic countryside park kind of environment. And on the one hand, it was praised for her work with light and color. On the other hand, she was pretty much consistently harshly criticized by various art critics in France at the time. But like I said, she really just continued to plug ahead and put out a lot of paintings in her lifetime. And her first solo show was in 1892, and it was very successful. And then unfortunately, she died in 1895 of pneumonia. So I think in many ways, she was cut short from perhaps having an even more prolific career. But she is just another of the lady impressionists that is very cool. We'll post some more paintings of hers for you to check out. But just wanted to give a little shout out to Bert. For you, Bert.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's so sad. Jeez.
I know.
You know, I think there's something that we kind of, like, haven't discussed. Like, we sort of touched on it, but, like, this whole idea of the bourgeois lifestyle really comes through in almost every Impressionist work.
Definitely.
So, like, Renoir, all of his, like, oh, the parties. Like, we're just having these fancy parties and
luncheons.
Everyone's just having luncheons on the grass.
Like the opera.
They're going to the opera. Yeah.
Everyone has their nice hats and their ribbons.
You know, a couple years back, I read this super just creepy article about Degas and the way that he painted these ballerinas.
Degas is hella problematic.
Ooh, Degas. Right up there with my boy Gauguin. collective groan. One thing that's really important to remember about the world of the Impressionists is that they are painting in this sort of new, like the bourgeois are this quote-unquote middle class that arises around the time of the Industrial Revolution in all over Europe. And so they're not royalty, they're new money, essentially. And so these people are living this just fancy pants lifestyle all the time. And so what comes through a lot are these images of leisure and these images of, like, spectacle, and it's, like, a spectacle of a spectacle, and so, yeah, I feel like, I wasn't gonna talk about Degas, but I just want to, because
we should definitely do an episode on him, because I have, like, a really weird, you know, problematic fave type situation with him, because, like, I'm a dancer, and so I always connected with images of his images of dancers, and then I found out more about him, and I was like, God damn it.
So look forward to a problematic boys. We're gonna call it that. We're gonna call it the problematic bays of
problematic ass boys.
Problematic ass boys.
Problematic posse.
Problematic.
Yeah, problematic.
So far
fuck
we
boys.
Yeah,
yeah. The fuck boys of art history.
Oh, that's gonna be it. Okay, but yeah, just I don't know, Degas. If you ever look at any of his paintings of the ballerinas, he paints them like baby horses. Like they just look like animals, and it's really interesting because of how these women were usually lower class. Mm-hmm. They were usually the line between dancer and prostitute was very thin. These older rich men. The richer you were, the more access you had, like, behind the curtain. And Degas back there.
Yeah.
You know?
What's Degas doing back there?
What are you doing back there, dude? Like, we're getting this, like, sort of in the background, sort of, like, mm-hmm. voyeuristic viewpoint. But it's his viewpoint.
Yeah.
We're just...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Just gonna move over quickly, talk about another really important figure in the world of the Impressionists, which was Claude Monet. We already discussed him a little bit in the beginning. Monet was born November 14th of 1840.
Okay.
Yeah. Scorpio, babe.
Yep.
So his father had been a sailor and then later would go on to manage the marine stores of his half-sister. So he's got some money. And so the young Claude had a very comfortable, happy childhood. He was fascinated by the harbor and ships and especially enjoyed the world of caricature. So
sure.
He's a happy child until his mom died when he was 17. And then he's not so happy anymore. He decides that he loves to paint, and with some money from caricatures that he sold and a small loan from his father, he arrives in Paris in 1859, and there he hooks up with many of the other artists of the time, so like Camille Pissarro, Edgar Degas, he hangs out with Renoir, Renoir's a good friend of his. So he's among this group, and so he quickly learns just what kind of themes are preoccupying the other artists, and he is a fast learner, and pretty soon he's having a great time in Paris. A little bit more about his life. In 1861, he had to leave Paris because every French man at this time, do they still do this? They have a mandatory military service.
I'm not sure.
So he was going to ask his dad to bail him out because you could just buy your way out of it, apparently. But then he found out that his dad knocked up a 19-year-old.
Oh!
And he was so mad that he said, fuck you, and decided to leave in anger and ended up in Algeria.
Understand.
He was pissed. He's like, you know what, dad? I'm going to go to Algeria.
She's only 2 years older than me, dad. Or was she younger than
I think? Money? I think that she was... definitely younger than him.
Oh,
creepy.
That's rough.
So he gets mad. He goes to Algeria, and in Algeria, he gets sick, and then his aunt buys him out. So he's kind of like a spoiled boy. And so he comes back, and he's in Paris, and so he really starts to get really interested in this world of the countryside. And so, like I said earlier, all these artists got disenchanted with the city. So Haussmannization's going on, which sounds cool, right? But it's not.
No.
It's
we
not
should do
cool.
an episode on Haussmannization.
Oh my god, it's pretty rough. So just imagine, you know, the inner city that we know of inner cities, right? There's usually a lot of poverty. So Haussmann just like uproots all these poor people and like kicks them out and is like, we're gonna make grand avenues right where your house used to be.
Yeah, no, aesthetically. Great idea, but
right.
when actually implemented, big
brutal.
Problem. Yeah.
Right. So many of these artists leave. They head for the countryside. They go, a popular locale was Fontainebleau. I'm not pronouncing
that
it
was
right.
Amazing.
Thank you.
I thought that was great.
That's like my wow, that's like good. My phony French accent that works sometimes. Yeah. It's crazy. So, and he goes out there with Renoir, his friend Basile, and an artist named Alfred Sisley from England, who had very bad luck. We're not going to get into his life because it's miserable, but it was just sad. And look him up. It's just sad. So Monet is so inspired by a Manet's Luncheon on the Grass that he decides he's going to make a Luncheon on the Grass. All right, we talked about this. Lunches.
You think you can paint a yeah. Luncheon on the Grass?
He's like, I'm going to paint a Luncheon on the Grass. And so he spends weeks and weeks and weeks studying the countryside, finding the perfect light. He finds it. It's great. He starts painting it. It's huge. He says it's going to be 4 meters by 6 meters. It's going to be a giant.
You are
going to
be
luncheon.
At that luncheon.
It's yeah. going to be a larger than life lunch. And he's so excited. And he's making this painting. And then he's in the studio. Okay, so side note, Monet was like constantly spending money like recklessly, and he would be in debt like several times in his life.
Damn.
So he's broke. He is doing this giant painting in his friend Basile's studio, or Basile, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, whatever. So he's working on this painting, and Gustave Courbet shows up and is like, hey, 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 how's the painting going? And he criticizes Monet's choice of light, and he's criticizing him. And so Monet gets so depressed by these negative comments by Courbet. And so, mind you, Manet and Courbet are sort of these people that these later impressionists, like the impressionists, like really admire.
Yeah.
And so to have, you know, Courbet be like, yo, this looks whack, is rough. So Monet becomes so depressed that he ends up just having to sell the studies for this giant painting just so that he can pay his rent. And he gives up on it. You can still see the remnants of this painting. So he...
Didn't part of it get water damaged?
Yes.
Like, he used it like bartering tool with mm-hmm. his landlord. Yeah. Yeah, and then it got water damaged mm-hmm. and destroyed like half of it.
Right.
So you can see it in pieces.
Exactly. So if you go to the Musée d'Orsay in France, you can see two pieces of this painting. So Monet gave it to him, the landlord rolled it up, put it away, and it got moldy. And so he came back, he said, damn it, in 1884, and he cut it up into three different pieces. One piece got lost, but two pieces exist, so you can still see it today. And it's great, it's huge, and it's really beautiful. And so I can only imagine what the final painting would have looked like. Anyway, so that was his first grand project that went to shit. Thanks, Courbet. But what he's most famous for are his water lilies. And the water lilies are a good place to wrap up sort of our segue into Impressionism, because the water lilies, he starts to do something a little bit different. And so really, many people have attributed Monet's water lilies as the birth of modern art. That is debatable, but for the purposes of my little segue here, That works.
We're going with that.
Yeah. So, you know, it's later in his life, and Monet is fighting against just overwhelming material and moral difficulties, which really were, like, a lot of his life was this way. And so by 1879, he's exhausted. His wife, Camille, she had a very long illness that left him just bankrupt. And then she died. And so it was like, damn it. So they don't know what it was. Tuberculosis. Some people say pelvic cancer. I read something about a botched abortion. I don't know.
Whoa.
But she leaves behind two children. One was only 18 months old. And he's living with this other couple. And then all of a sudden, the husband of the other couple dies. And he ends up marrying the woman.
Sure,
and
why not?
So hey. Whatever, right? It just worked out.
Yeah. Make the best of a convenience.
Yeah,
bad
like,
situation.
Okay, like, shit, our, like, spouses died. Let's get married. And so they do. And her name is Alice. And she seems like she made him happy. And
she sounds lovely.
In 1883, Monet moves to Giverny, which is a pastoral place in France. It's pretty. And it's right off of the Seine. It's the River Seine. Is it Seine?
Seine.
Seine. The River Seine. And it's beautiful. And so that is where Monet starts to make some of his, like, most famous works. And he starts to get famous. And he starts to make money. So in 1892, he finally experiences some fame. He paints the Rouen Cathedral, which is a very famous Monet, the Haystacks, and his Poplar series. So he's tremendously successful. He makes 9,000 francs, which is a lot for homie who has been in debt and broke his whole life. With that money, he decides to make his own garden. And the garden is still there. You can still see it at Giverny.
Oh,
and
I would love to see that.
I know. It's so pretty. It's crazy. There's a river nearby called the River Epte, or Ept, I don't know. And he decided to divert a little arm of the river, and he made his own pond. Oh. He just made his own pond! And he plants weeping willows and bamboo.
So cute.
And he just makes this beautiful place. It's his own private garden.
Weeping willows are the most magical,
so beautiful, majestic trees.
And a fun fact about this area or his gardens is that apparently he landscaped by, like, color and kind of just like his own impulse rather than any sort of, you know, like, actual gardening
landscape
technique.
Right.
And he didn't like really trim things down or keep close tabs on them. He kind of let them grow naturally.
Like overgrowth.
Yeah.
He wanted it to just be this wild, like, with the little hidden bridge.
Oh,
and he had
God.
A Japanese the Japanese garden very in at the time.
Yeah.
Okay. Japan is a big deal for the Impressionists.
Japanese man.
Especially post-Impressionism. We'll talk about this later. He made his own garden, and it was beautiful, and sure enough, there were water lilies, and he starts to paint this series of water lilies, and the water lilies are just what Monet is just known for. They're giant, okay? If you ever get to see them, they're just huge. There's a great picture in this book, The Lost World of the Impressionists. So he conceived of this project as a never-ending hole that would envelop visitors. So you go into this room at the Musée de l'Orangerie, near the Louvre. And it's just this white room. There's like a series, there's like benches in the middle, and his water lilies just like envelop the entire room. There's a curved one. So the room is like an oval because he didn't use like a flat canvas. He used like long, like stretched out canvas. And that's the picture. So there's a picture of him in his studio.
Cool.
He's so cute. He's got this
huge beard.
He's got this giant palette. There's just a fancy, like comfy looking couch in the middle. And the painting is, like, dwarfing him. They're huge. It's at this moment that Monet really just starts to do something different. And at this point, he's really just destroying form with color. And many people look at these series of paintings and attribute it as a precursor to modernism. So Monet, it's safe to say, lived out the rest of his years happily and in Giverny. And I just like to believe that he just had a good old time, grew out his beard really long, and was taking strolls every day in his Japanese garden with Alice, and was
this
just having
amazing.
Such a nice time.
I would love to have my own garden.
Right? Mm-hmm. The same cannot be said for many of the other Impressionists. It's kind of sad. Yeah, a lot of them just got real old and died alone. Look up Mr. Alfred.
Sisley.
Alfred Sisley. His life was real sad. He got paralyzed for some reason. I think he spent too much time outdoors is what the book said.
What?
he just got like sick and paralyzed.
Did he get like polio?
I don't know. He just they call it rheumatism, and he just died. And Dagos was going blind, and he was just angry and didn't want anyone to go near his studio. People were buying his work, but they didn't get it. And he was angry, and so he died angry and alone. Cezanne died just real broke. Anecdote, he got invited to Monet's beautiful house in Giverny that was, like, frequented by famous people. Like, the president went there and hung out with him. Cezanne was so overwhelmed by his friend's success that he was in tears. And, like, he died later on. Renoir died, and as he was dying, he asked if he could be brought his easel and his palette and his paintbrushes. So, bummer times. Yeah, the Impressionists, they just sort of faded away, and
much like an impression.
Oh, man. So sad, sad, but we're not going to wrap it up on a sad note. We're going to wrap it up on a positive note.
Listener mail.
So this one comes to us from an anonymous babe on Tumblr, but it's super cute. I love your podcast so much. My boyfriend lives about an hour and a half from me, and I drive down normally twice a week or so. While I drive, I always listen to you girls, and it puts me in the best mood. The most recent time, I got into town, and his sister pointed out some cherubs on the ceiling of the little Italian restaurant we were in.
Oh, no, girl.
Thanks to y'all, I was able to not only correct her, but tell her all about Pootie. Now my boyfriend calls me Puto, and I love it. Continue being babes. How cute is that?
That is cute.
That's adorable.
You can call him Puto, too. Technically, the Puto are only boys, which is super dumb.
It doesn't matter,
but
though.
It doesn't matter at all because you embody the Puto
spirit.
If
you're living anywhere around, like, Los Angeles, though, you probably don't want to be calling your boyfriend Puto on the streets because some cholos are going to laugh at him. But anyway, you can look that up.
The magic of the Pootie lives on.
You sweet, sweet baby
Thank
angel.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, that's so great.
That's such a sweet
That episode
mail.
Seems also, like, such a long time ago. It wasn't actually that long ago, but I'm like, whoa, Weird Pootie was a lifetime ago.
That was a fun one. We should do another one like Weird Pootie where we just pick out like an interesting
like weird babies.
We said we were gonna do ugly babies. Yeah. I feel like if we do ugly Jesus, we're gonna be in trouble.
Probably ugly baby Jesus?
Most of them were Jesus, to be fair. He was the only baby pan for
people,
a while.
Like, let's be real, people really struggled with babies for a long time, and they were trying to paint baby Jesus, and
they had no models. They just
didn't know what to do.
I mean, like, are you telling me they couldn't just grab a baby and paint a baby?
Dude, even Da Vinci's babies were, like, fucked up, and that's saying a lot.
Babies have weird proportions.
Damn.
That's what makes them so cute, is they're disproportionate.
If I try to draw a baby, like I'd probably
exactly.
fuck
up.
Exactly! Yeah. Yeah,
whoa,
this proportion is cute. I don't understand it, but it's a real thing.
Oh, it's like a whole evolutionary thing. they make babies cute so that we like feed them and don't kill them.
Yeah, no,
that's real.
I heard that on a TED Talk.
Yeah, that's a real thing. I watched the same one. Yeah, so babies are cute so that you don't kill them, huh? Okay.
They are damn cute, though. I love me a good baby.
Look forward to an ugly baby episode.
We'll do it. Especially from, like, Renaissance period.
Oh,
that's
man.
Some gold mines.
There's, I mean...
Ugly Byzantine babes.
Oh!
Those Byzantine babies.
They literally look just like small old men. Yeah. Like, that are just, like, holding on to Virgin Mary, like... Get out of here, dude.
Like a rigid hand.
Yeah.
That's just when there's like one boob out and he's just
And the boobs are all fucked up too.
Of course.
They're like not natural at all. They're like super rounded.
Yeah, and like where's the areola? Like that exists.
They didn't know.
They had no idea.
They had never seen it.
They were doing their best.
Good. All right.
But yeah, on that note, thanks for listening to our episode about Impressionism. If you like us, go to our website, arthistorybabes.com. If you really like us and want to do us a huge solid, you can go to patreon.com/arthistorybabes and donate us some spare change, and we'll love you forever.
Whatever you got.
Whatever you got. Like, we really appreciate it. Also, we are on Instagram at Art History Babes Podcast, Twitter at Art History Babes, and we're on Facebook. Like us on Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes. Write us a review on iTunes.
That's a good one.
All of those things you can do mm-hmm. are fantastic, and we love everyone who does them. So thank you so much for your support. Y'all are great.
We appreciate you.
We do.
We really do.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Yeah.
That's the
Maybe
devil.
Maybe Olympia was a witch.
That is the devil.
That's the devil.
The Art History Babes podcast is made possible by support from our lovely listeners via Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/arthistorybabes to help keep the Art History Babes going and for access to bonus content.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.